Welcome to Regional Voices, the WNIN program to preserve and promote the arts, culture, and civil discussion. I'm your host, Steve Berger. This episode is about The Big Read. The Big Read is a program of the National Endowment for the Arts designed to revitalize the role of literature in American culture and to encourage citizens to read for pleasure and enlightenment. The NEA presents The Big Read in partnership with Arts Midwest. WNIN partners with the University of Southern Indiana to record and broadcast interviews pertaining to the book promoted by The Big Read. This year, it's The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. There are a number of book discussions and other public events in the month of February related to The Big Read. More information is available at usi.edu/bigread. Students from area schools interviewed Depression-era survivors for this program. The students' comments are included following some of these survivor interviews. The first interview is with Jerry Hammers, with student comments by University of Evansville student Jonathan Betcher.
Geraldine Wilma Hammers. Well, I was approximately 4 or 5 years old. I thought it was really sad because my mother and father had gotten married in 1925, and they bought this beautiful home on Olive Street, 2313 Olive Street, where we lived. And then, of course, when the Depression came, my father was working at Hercules Body, there where Chrysler is now in Garvin. And, of course, things got bad, and they lost their home. They were not able to make their payments, and Mr. Whittakent owned the home, and he did everything. He hauled coal and cleaned out garages and all different things, and we just weren't able to make it. So we moved in with my grandmother, my mother's mother, Wilhelmina Gosley, and we lived there until 1935, when they were able to, my grandmother helped them, I think, gave them some money to buy the house at 102 West Michigan Street. And we moved in there in 1935. In fact, I just sold the house 2 years ago. And so we were the only one in the family to live in town, because my father had 5 brothers and 1 sister, and his 1 sister lived in McCutcheonville, and they had a big farm. So between, we had chickens on Michigan Street, believe it or not. And when the flood came up in 1937, my uncles and aunts, 3 of them, came to live with us in our house at 102, and the one brother lived with my aunt out in McCutcheonville. And I went to Baker School. I was born in 1928, and I thought it was really sad that losing your home is pretty sad, you know, no place to go, and there wasn't food stamps or anything. You just made the best of what you could do. And my dad finally got a job at Chrysler, and he worked there, well, I guess till he retired. He did part-time work at Hahn Incorporated, where they made farm implements too. And my mother was a stay-at-home mom. I'm an only child, and I was very well blessed, and lots of discipline, being an only child, but I had chores to do. And as far as the Depression, I mean, I guess we were one of the few that survived. Well, we only had 3 rooms. We had the parlor, or the living room, the bedroom, and then the dining room. And then my father finally added on a little kitchenette back, because We didn't have plumbing at all. We didn't have electric lights. My grandmother had gas lights, which was very interesting. So the power didn't go out. Mm-hmm. And then he did put in a commode in the little room that he added on. So we survived very good. But my grandmother, all the time during the Depression, honey, she worked at Pearl Laundry, and she was really our main breadwinner, I know. It's just fabulous how well she took care of her daughter. Really, there was not much of anything. We would maybe go down to my aunts and uncles in Union Township. They had a big farm, and we would help out down there. And my grandmother and grandfather, my dad's mom and dad, had 9 children, and they were all farmers, except my father, of course. And that was our entertainment, because every Sunday we would have family dinners together. When I was growing up, too, my entertainment was I went to the baseball game at Garvin's Park. That was a bunch of girls. I liked to play tennis. And then we went down to the community center, which was the old railroad on 8th Street, where the 4 columns, you know, that are. And that was really, I didn't have a very sociable life, but I was blessed. I think bread was 5 cents a loaf, but my grandmother was a very good cook, and we were able to have eggs, and then with my uncles having farm and hogs and chickens and everything. We never starved to death, that's for sure, but not much income. I mean, if it hadn't been for my grandmother, I guess we would have gotten welfare or something, whatever they had, a WPA, I don't know. My mother had a sewing machine, and she, my grandmother didn't have chickens, but our neighbors did. And the material that the chicken feed came in was very useful, because I've had several things that were made out of the chicken feeds, and they were very pretty, colorful. Yes. So, and then later when we moved on Michigan Street, my father, at Easter time, would get 100 chickens from Helton Felker, and then 6 weeks later he would get another 200. We had chicken pens there at 102 West Michigan Street in town, which was not, you couldn't have that nowadays, chickens in the city, you know, but we had plenty of eggs, and so we did fine. Really, I guess we were all pretty well blessed. I mean, we would put plaster, if we had a bad cold or flu or whatever, we would have something called a mustard thing that we'd put on flannel and then put it next to the stove and then put it on real quick and cover it up for a cough. And I forgot what, I had the mumps, and I had the chicken pox, and you know, I really don't recall even having a doctor having to have to come to the house at all. Oh dear, honey, how we survived. 1932, I think it was getting to be a little more stable. I can't exactly remember the date that things began to get on their feet, more or less. I just can't, of course, the 37 flood was really pretty bad. A lot of people lost their homes, and a lot of sickness, you know, there was an awful lot of sickness. And in fact, three of my uncles that lived down in Union Township, the one had lots of animals, cows and horses and pigs, of course, and somehow or the other, they had a barge and took it across the Ohio River to Henderson, Kentucky, somewhere. And I know my uncle hadn't slept for over, about a week and a half, and he was just, and I think they had a little booze to kind of keep him going or something, you know. Of course, I went to kindergarten at Baker School until 1944, and the schools were very good because they gave a recess in the morning, and we would get, for a nickel, we would get graham crackers and milk in the morning, and then we would go home for lunch. I would walk home to Harriet Street, and because I went to kindergarten when I lived on Harriet Street, but then I think first or second grade, then that's when we moved on Michigan Street. My dates aren't too good, real. Sorry, I didn't make an outline, which I should have done. My father had a truck, and I know a lot of times when I was saying he was cleaning out garages and hauling corn and everything, and I don't know what the model was, but I know when you'd ride at it, it make your feet go to sleep. It shook so bad, you know. Wasn't power steering. But we did good.
My name's Jonathan Betcher. I had most of what I have ever heard about the Great Depression or ever learned about the Great Depression has been from secondhand accounts, from history books and things like that. So, you know, I've heard stories and I've seen documentaries about the nation as a whole, things like that. But this is my first time to really ever talk to someone who was there and who experienced it. And I guess it was different than what I expected, because whenever I think about the Great Depression after looking at history books and things like that, you just kind of picture everybody as being downtrodden, and I mean, it's called the Great Depression. You picture everybody being depressed. And interviewing Jerry just kind of made me realize that life still went on regardless of how the economy was doing. And even though things were hard, and even though they had to pull together and work a little harder to get through it, life still went on. You know, she talked about how they got along just fine. She talked about how they would go to church every Sunday as a family, how they would eat meals together. And I guess it's really made me think about how things are now, how sometimes we put such a focus on things that they didn't have back then, and we have them now. But it kind of made me wonder, I guess, about, you know, maybe what they had back then, or maybe what they didn't have back then made them realize that what they did have was more important. And I guess it made me think about the fact that I still have those things that she had back then. I have a family, and I, you know, I have people around me, I have friends and things like that. And that maybe I shouldn't let the other things that I have, the other things that I've been blessed with, take away from the importance of those things. You know, maybe I need to take a little more time to eat dinner with my family. Maybe I need to slow down a little bit and get a little less focused on just all the abundance that we have, and focus a little more on things that are maybe a little more important than that.
The next segment is Mel Peterson, interviewed by Mount Vernon High School student Kara Hoskins.
Hello, my name is Melvin Peterson. I survived the Great Depression of 1929 as a 7, 8, 9-year-old child, and I remember some of the things about it. My first introduction to it was at the age of 7 when my father told me, "You no longer have $75 in the bank. The bank is closed." But he said, "I'll make it up for you." Well, I especially remember one night we came home. I don't know, it was probably in 1930, and the cellar door was open. My father started to go down there, and Mother said, "Don't go down there, Al. There might be someone down there." So he sent the dog down. The dog came back wagging its tail. And my father went down and said, "There's absolutely nothing on the shelves." Mother had been canning food all summer. The shelves were full of jars, and someone had taken them. Well, we mainly ate off the land. Even our meat came from the land. But all of our neighbors and relatives, I know, received what they called relief, which was food given to them by the government. And we never did need any. We always had plenty to eat. Well, it was all store-bought then, because when they cleaned out our cellar of food, they also went in the house and completely stripped the house of all of our clothing and everything in it except the furniture. Bread? Well, one thing I remember very well, I always got everything I asked for, probably a spoiled brat of an only child. But I remember getting, if I wanted a new sled or a wagon or even a pony, I got them. But otherwise, just had the things that other children had. I remember my first bicycle. I was 9 years old, and I still remember it cost $29.75. Well, of course, the drought came at the same time, so there was nothing to feed the animals to, which were you were dependent on eating. We did have a few dairy cattle, and my father sold the milk to someone who picked it up every day, and it was taken and bottled to the people who lived in the city of Omaha. And the one thing I remember about that is that we usually got a check for about $30 twice a month for the milk that we sold. And my mother, being the good businesswoman that she was, always kept three checks. She kept, when one came in, then she'd cash the oldest one, but she always kept those three. Well, one funny thing I remember, one morning I came out the back door, and there was all this money hanging on the clothesline with clothespins. And I thought, where in the world did that come from? And I asked my father, who'd never charged anything in his life. If he bought a tractor, he paid cash. If he bought a farm, he paid cash. But he said, I'm going down to pick up a new car today, and the money smelled so musty and moldy, I thought I would air it out before I paid it. But in those, they even had a program for teenagers during the Depression. It was called the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, where teenagers, so they wouldn't be eating at home, were put in work camps and paid a very minimum amount, which was sent to their family. Well, very often, a lot of our neighbors were on what was called WPA at the time, the Works Progress Administration, and which did a great deal of good at that time in building roads and bridges and buildings and everything. And my father would take them to work and go and get them. But he didn't have to work on WPA. And also, they would get food, which was called relief at the time. And I remember the first time I ever tasted grapefruit was one of the neighbors had gotten in their relief box a big bag of grapefruit. That was all they got. And so they shared it with us.
I learned from this interview that how different people's lives were during the Depression, from some people needing clothing from the government and from others realizing that there was a tough time but maybe not noticing it because they were at a younger age. And another thing that I learned is that families really stuck together through the time and neighbors were different. I mean, nowadays neighbors might not give the help that they needed, but to share their grapefruits, which is something that maybe not be unheard of nowadays if they were really hungry and needed it, that would be something really important to do, and they really cared about each other at the time.
In our next segment, Mary Schmidt, who was interviewed by her granddaughter, USI student Tessa Livers.
As a little girl, my average day was probably just playing like everybody else. And then when I started school, walk to school with the rest of the kids on the block. And we were all poor, so we was in it together. My dad, he worked on cars, he hauled coal. Just about everybody used coal back then. But then he finally landed a job at Mead Johnson, and things went better after that. I lived on the west side in Evansville on Franklin Street. And went to school at Sacred Heart School in Evansville. Then Mom and Dad we outgrew that house when my brothers and sisters were born. Then they bought a house on Mount Vernon Avenue, which is just about six blocks from there, bought a bigger house then. And then later on, when my grandpa come to live with us and we all got a little older, Mom and Dad bought a farm in St. Wendell, Indiana. Dad always wanted to go back to farming. We made do as the family grew. Mom and Dad managed to buy bigger houses and make room for us. Well, my dad was a meat and potato man, but we had our vegetables because we had a garden, and that helped along with the food too. Then. We had tomatoes, green beans, potatoes, all the good stuff. There were, back in those days, we called them beggars. Now we call them street people. Yes, they were hungry. They needed food. And we lived close to a brickyard where they made the bricks. And those ovens were hot where they baked the bricks, and those poor people didn't have a bed or a house to live in. They laid around those ovens and kept warm in the wintertime. And whatever leftovers we had when they knocked on the door, my mom would fix them a plate. Well, we didn't have TV and we didn't have our iPhones and all that stuff, so we played a lot of baseball, and Dad made a swing set for us in the backyard. And we had a big sandbox. We had the biggest sandbox in the neighborhood. Everybody come to play in our sandbox. So our yard was kind of a center for the kids. But we were lucky. Dad was a pretty good car mechanic, and he could take any old car and make it run. And It was a godsend blessing for him and our family because he helped out our relatives with their cars and helped keep them running. Well, we had a lot of extreme weather in 1936 and 37 and 38. In 1936, there was a day in July where the temperature was 116 degrees, I believe it was. It was very hot. And then that followed, we had the flood in 1937. And we were on the outskirts of town, so that didn't affect us. We were high and dry. But my grandparents and two of my uncles and an aunt, they were in the middle of town, in the middle of Evansville, what they call the Lamasco area. It's around Fulton Avenue. The water didn't get to them, but the water surrounded them, and there was gasoline floating on top of the water, and they had to get out because there was such a danger of fire. So they came down to live with us. So we had, my grandma and grandpa went down the basement and fired up the cook stove and started making some cinnamon kuchens and bread and all that. I can still smell that sweet smell of bread. And then us kids, we played around down the basement. We had tricycles and skates and stuff. And
this project has taught me that sometimes even through the hard times, you can make it through. And my grandma taught me that with faith and a little work, that you can make it through anything.
Up next, Chris Nix, who was interviewed by Wrights High School student Zach Cook.
I'm Chris Nix, and I'm here to talk about the Great Depression. I was living in a small town in North Central Iowa, and it was called Brett, Iowa. And it was in a farming community. When I was 3 years old, on my third birthday, my mother gave my older brother a fairly new pair of coveralls to wear, and she gave me his old, worn-out ones. I remember being extremely angry. I think I threw a good tantrum, and I just hated wearing old hand-me-down clothes. We lived in a home that was almost like a shed, and it was up on stilts, like short stilts, and the house was four rooms, and all of the children slept in one room. We had a pot-bellied stove in the living room, and of course a cook stove in the kitchen. Stove would go out in the night, and the temperature of the house would get whatever the temperature would be almost outside. One night, we had a snowstorm, and there was a window broken in our bedroom, and the snow drifted in on the floor, and it was extremely cold. Had no running water, no electric. The outside toilets, that was kind of standard for all farmers back in those days. No toilet tissue. You used magazines, Sears and Roebuck catalogs, anything you could get at that time. And things were very, very deplorable. The schoolhouse was a one-room schoolhouse down the road about a half a mile, and all grades were taught there from 1 to 8. I started in school when I was 4 years old. The teacher would get up, come to school early, and start the fire in the furnace. And of course, she taught all the grades. And then if we had a snowstorm in the winter, and it was hard to find our way home. I had two older sisters and an older brother that we'd all hold hands and walk home so we would all stay together. The conditions were very, very, very deplorable then. The Dust Bowl affected us some. The crops were quite They were affected greatly because of the dryness. Every time we'd go to get our equipment or something, we'd have to brush the dust off the equipment. And whenever the dust would blow from the southwest, which it did quite often, we'd have to close all the windows in the house, and it would get extremely hot in the house. This would be in the summertime when it would be 90 or 95 degrees. So we were affected some, but nothing compared to the people in the immediate area of it. In 1936, I was 10 years old, not quite 11 yet. My father and my stepmother went to Oregon. They were pretty well disgusted with living up in Iowa with the cold temperatures. So they came back from that trip and said, well, we're going to move to Oregon. And that fall, after we had harvested the crops, and my father bought an old truck that had been turned over, and the cab was all mashed, and he probably bought it for a little of a very small amount. So we worked on it and worked on it and got it hammered out, and it still looked horrible. But then it was time to leave for Oregon. So we had an old Model A car, and my older sister rode with my father and my stepmother. My brother, older brother, and my older brother, the oldest one, drove the truck. The truck just looked almost like the Grapes of Wrath. It had a tarp over the bedding on it, and we got out into Wyoming, and the bearing went out in the truck, and that was almost a catastrophe. We had to get a workman from Billings in to repair the bearing, and then, of course, when we finally had that repaired, we were on our way. And when we arrived in Oregon, we stayed at my stepmother's aunt's home for a while. And then we bought a home close to Woodburn, Oregon, 20 acres. But at that time, it was in the dead of the winter, there was no work. And our money was running out, and it was through the good graces of the neighbors that they brought food to us. And that's what kept us going. Early in the spring, why the hop fields and would open up, and they only paid 15 cents an hour to work at that time. So my father and my older brother worked there. And then later on, this other migrant farm work opened up, and we worked in the berry fields, the bean fields, the strawberry fields, and strawberry fields were, a lot of the larger ones were owned by the Japanese people, and it was like a camp. We'd go and stay all week in a tents and pick the berries, and I always just hated that work. I hated living in those camps. So this lasted for many years, working in the migrant farm work and working in the fields like that. And the pay never did get any more than 20 cents an hour. So you had to, you never could see $2 a day hardly for your work there. When the after the war broke out and they started hiring people in the shipyards in Portland, gosh, the pay there was $1.20 an hour for a worker, and I thought, oh, that's so great that to go from 20 cents an hour up to $1.20. And it was almost like heaven. I saved money then, and it was such a good feeling. Well, the type of food that we had to eat was almost the same thing over and over and over. We would raise some sweet corn on the farm, and we'd make hominy out of that. And not too many people are familiar with hominy anymore, but it was substantial food. We always had, seemed like we always had pancakes to eat for breakfast, but we never had any syrup. We just had sugar and water mixed, and I don't know what they call that. There's a name for that, but that wasn't too bad. And we had quite a bit of beef on the farm, and we always had some chickens, so we had eggs. So while we were in Iowa, we always had enough food to eat, but our trouble came when we moved to Oregon and we had nothing to rely on there. In the evenings, they were so boring, no radio, no electric. We had the old coal lamps that you lit, and just a little better than candles. And we played cards. We'd gather around a table, and we just played cards, and we just we wore those cards out. And then we popped popcorn. And so that was our entertainment, and that was the only entertainment we had for years while we lived in Iowa. Well, as I was going through all of that time, I thought, someday I'm going to rise above this. It may take me a while, but I'm going to rise above it. And my time finally came after I got out of the service and came to Evansville, and that's when my time came to rise above all of that. Well, whenever someone became ill, or in those days, hardly anybody could afford a doctor. And this is true, I think, throughout the country. There were doctors available, and the medical field at that time, of course, wasn't anything compared to today. But you just tried to do the best you could, and you tried to survive the best you could. And a lot of times it would not happen.
Finally, we hear from Mamie Dowell, also interviewed by Kara Hoskins.
My name is Dowell, D-O-W-E-L-L. My first name is Mamie, M-A-M-I-E. I think I was probably 8, and I remember thinking what was going on because my stepfather didn't have a job, and he was leaving every day going to stand in line to get bread or whatever they were handing out that day. And I heard my mother say, we have to go because we won't have anything to eat. Then my mother heard about them passing out clothes for children, certain ages. And she said, this is really a depression. And of course, we didn't know really what that meant. But we thought, we are really, really poor people. And this was not in the country. This was in the city of Nashville, Tennessee, right in the heart of Nashville, about 8 blocks from downtown. Mostly beans, potatoes, oatmeal, rice. There was cornbread, not much sliced bread because we didn't have that luxury at that time. And a lot of things like people grew in their gardens, those that could would pass that along. Then we'd get a lot of vegetables that way. The only way we got the vegetables was the gardens that people grew in their yards, because the beans, the rice, the wheat, the oatmeal was given to you when you stood in line. That's how you got those things. An average day was getting up, going to school with my mother, sometimes making biscuits. And it was no surprise, there was nothing unusual about a child bringing his lunch to school, wrapped in newspaper, and the lunch would consist of biscuits. Biscuits, fried, what they call smoked bacon, or the white bacon, they'd say smoke or white bacon, and that was, white bacon hadn't been cured, it hadn't been smoked. And so they'd fry that, and they'd put it on the biscuits, and the kids would take it to school. Or they'd take a molasses sandwich, and sorghum molasses was something they would pass out in line also. Nobody laughed at you because you came to school with biscuits rolled up in newspaper for your lunch, because at least you had something to eat, because a lot of kids came to school and didn't bring newspaper lunches, so you knew they didn't have anything to eat. And sometimes the teacher would have us to give and divide our lunch with somebody else. And then you come home, from school, and you were met with the smell, excuse me, you were met with the smell of beans cooking. And that was great because you knew you were going to have something to eat. Sometimes the beans had meat in them and sometimes they didn't. Sometimes it was just the beans cooking. And of course it was cooked on a wood stove or a coal stove. And you had to help warm the house with that same heat that you were cooking the beans with. So if you didn't have enough wood to run all the stoves, there was a stove in a bedroom, that was the huge kitchen stove that had four burners on it, we call them eyes. And if you didn't have enough coal wood to run that stove, you closed off the kitchen and you heated the food with the same stove in the bedroom that heated the bedrooms. So it was good to see that cooking when you came home, because at least you knew you were going to have something to eat. And your mother had to iron the clothes. If she didn't have the luxury of having an electric iron, they were irons that you put on the stove and you heat those irons. So you'd have about five irons. They would cover them with a pan that you could possibly use to bake bread in, to hold the heat on the iron. So if they had six or seven irons, that was because they would use the iron till it cooled, put that iron back, pick up another hot iron from that stove to iron your clothes. So your mother would be there ironing and the pot of beans cooking. That was for supper. And then the cornbread would come later. The loss of people's jobs, people standing in line, and men. And I know they had to feel bad because they couldn't take care of their families. And the loss of people, now this we heard, of lives. People lost their lives because they committed suicide, because they couldn't stand the idea of everything being taken from them, and they lost a lot. People lost their savings. We didn't, but we knew some people that did. And then they lost their lives. So the families lost their money, their livelihood, and then they lost a parent. So they lost a lot. And I remember people crying about that. And at the time, Hoover had been elected. He was the president at the time of the barest of essentials in the United States. I remember that much. And I remember them praising the idea that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected president because Hoover had done such a bad, bad job of helping his country to rise above the Great Depression. And it caused, as my uncle said, it caused a lot worldwide, because when we fell, it spread around the world, actually. And there is a lot of people suffering the Great Depression. We weren't the only ones. Well, at the time, as I said, my stepfather, and he was a precious man. I just loved him to death, because my dad had passed away, and he was my stepdad. And they had the four children after me. And I was so sad to see him. I remember him coming in looking so sad so many times, because he couldn't take care of his family. I think most of the time I remember my mom crying because we didn't have enough clothes sometimes for everybody to even go to school. That if this one had shoes without holes in them and couldn't put enough cardboard or whatever in, then they wore the good shoes. Then the next day, the next one went to school and wore those same shoes, even if they were a little big. The actual clothing that the government gave everybody was really nice clothing. It wasn't really bad. It's just the idea that you knew where everybody got those clothing. You went to school, and if you were an 8 or 19-year-old girl, you got a certain style of dress. And so when you walked into your classroom and you see five or six girls with their dress, everybody knew where they got them. But nobody ragged on each other, because you happened to have the clothes. And the boys got a certain type of shirt, certain type of pants, But we were glad to get them because the people didn't have enough clothes for their kids to even all of their children to go to school. And there were so many families that had multiple children in the family. It wasn't a family like one or two kids. They seemed to get along pretty good. But the families that had three, four, five, six kids, like my mom had five, there were some families had 12 and 15 kids. And that's unheard of these days. But, you know, there are a few. but it was just tremendous for that many people to be hungry in one house, to go to bed at night hungry and wake up hungry. And we did sometimes, very seldom, but very, very seldom we went to bed hungry, woke up hungry. But there was sometimes we did. And my mother would cry. I knew why she was crying, because she couldn't feed us. There was no food. And my stepdad would go down the street, and the grocery stores, those that were, they had, say for instance, some corn had been old and was turning brown at one end. They'd throw that corn out, and people would go get it and use it. There were a lot of people that rummaged through the discarded food from the grocery stores. Very few people had cars. I remember that when I was younger, that my grandfather had a old, I don't know, you kids know about a Studebaker? And it had what they call a rumble seat. It didn't have like a convertible. The convertible was a rumble seat, and you pull it from the top back, and two people could sit in it. And then when you close the car, and it just had the round back. And I had one of those, not me, but my grandfather did, and I rode with him everywhere in it. But when my mom was married, they didn't have a car. So we walked everywhere. We walked to Carter Lawrence School, which was, there was segregation, of course, you know. And so on South Street, there was a school called South Street Elementary. And then we went to Carter Elementary. Well, then there was a place called Lawrence Elementary School. Well, they did decide to build a new school. And once they built a new school, they built it at 12th and Edge Hill. Well, my mom and us, we lived right in that block. So those people had to be displaced. They displaced those people, and you had to find your own way. They didn't try to find you houses like they maybe do here in Evansville sometimes, try to find people living quarters if they tell you you have to move because we're going to tear down this thing. Well, they didn't. Then you were on your own finding a place to live. And so right now, that school stands there, Carter Lawrence Elementary. That's where I ended up going to school. And we lived on Overton, which was, I'd say, 12 blocks, maybe 12 or 13 blocks. And we had to walk there. There was no bus fare to take us there, and there was no car to drive us there. And so my brothers, we walked to school, we walked from school, and that school was also going west about 12 to 15 blocks from Vanderbilt Hospital. And so anything you did, you had to walk and do it. I had to walk and take my baby sisters to get their inoculation shots. My brothers, we walked.
So what was it like at school?
It was all right at school. I remember because I loved school, I always did. And so I really didn't have a problem going to school, in spite of the fact that sometimes you wonder, were we going to have dinner when I got home? Because I didn't see anything when I left home for dinner. And so some kids would say, can I come over to your house and eat? And I would say, yes. You know how kids did. Because my kids did the same thing. But what we did, if we were preparing dinner for my kids now, at the age when my daughter over there, my kids was growing up, I said, this kid is standing there looking at you and saying, Mama, can't he stay and eat dinner tonight? And you've got a chop for each child. And you say, yeah, but we're going to have to divide up your chop. and let him come right on. I never said, no, he can't, because we don't have enough to feed him. Well, in my day, you didn't do that because you didn't know you were going to have any food. When a child would say, can I go home with you? I can remember crying because the little child couldn't stay and eat with us, but we didn't have anything either. We were waiting on my stepdad to come in and bring something. And he would later come in one time and had a whole thing of bologna. And my mother cooked cornbread with yellow meal, and we ate that bologna and cornbread for supper. And I said, he should have stayed, because she could have had something. And my mother said, I know, honey, but she's gone now. Because we just didn't have anything when she was there. So I enjoyed my stay at school, even though I ran into situations like that. I enjoyed going to school. I enjoyed going to high school. And my daughter always talked about, don't be too long-winded. But I got a certificate at the end of class, at the end of my high school, for never missing a day of high school. And that's not too much going on today. And that's kind of rare today. But I did get, when I had left school, have come to school and had to leave to have a tooth pull, or I had to leave because I cut my leg and got stitches. But to say I missed school, just call in and say I won't be there today, never. And I got a certificate for that. So I love school, even in spite of all that was going on around me, the sadness, the not enough food, whatever. Well, we played hopscotch, and we had to play it in the street because the park was like 9 or 10 blocks from us, so we couldn't walk to the park every day. My mother wouldn't let us. Whenever we went to the park, she'd go with us, and she didn't always wasn't available to go with us. And so we'd play hopscotch. We'd draw the squares in the street, and when the cars come by, we just move aside to the car pass and go back to our hopscotch. We play ball in the street. And, you know, we broke a couple of windows and got in trouble. But we had a wide plank, you know, a little plank, and we would get some kind that was pliable, not the really, really heavy, but just right to hit the balls. And that is on Overton Street. South Street runs east to west. Overton Street ran north-south. And South Street was a street, say, like Washington or Lincoln. It was a very busy through street. And we'd knock balls across that street and have to run out there and almost get hit a lot of times, you know. But the cars would stop for us because it really wasn't that many cars, but it was a through street because didn't that many people really have cars. So they weren't riding that many. But at certain times, maybe 4:30 or so, you see a lot of cars moving.
What did your house look like?
We had electric lights, but before we got electric lights, we had lamp light. And lamp light is run with oil. And at that time it was coal oil. You call it coal oil. And you put it in the lamp, and there was a wick, and you'd have to clean those. You couldn't, because it could catch fire. My mother would have, that was a job we had. Each room had its own lamp. So we'd have to take those lamps off, wash them, and I remember we shined them up with newspaper. You take newspaper and you put it inside the lamp and twist it and roll it around till you get all this soot. And that soot came from the wick that you could turn it up or turn it down. You turn it up, make the room brighter, turn it down, make it dimmer. But you had to be careful of the lamps because they could be dangerous. And then you had a mantle. Every room usually had a fireplace and a mantle, and you sit that lamp on the mantle. And that's how you had the light. And people would have those. My mother would have us scrubbing porches in the rooms with lye soap. They made soap, and it was lye soap. And it would turn the wood white almost, because she'd have us out there scrubbing it and rinsing it off and scrubbing it and rinsing it. And the outhouse, before we got the flushing toilets, we'd have to scrub that. Nobody wanted to do that. Everybody lied and said that it wasn't their time, you know, because nobody wanted to go out there and do that. But the inside of the house was clean. My mother had lace, starch curtains, everything starched. You don't see a lot of that now. People spray a little bit, but I mean, this was starch. These curtains were starched. They stand out from the windows. And she would do that, wipe windows, seals out. My mother was, I don't want to say fanatic about housekeeping, but she was raised, I guess, that way. And she worked us to death, she, cleaning yards. Some of our yard was bare because the grass wouldn't grow. We were sweeping that up and had to take a dustpan and carry it to the back room. So it looked really nice. I was proud of our house. People thought our house, you know, they would come in and say, ooh, ooh. And we thought, what? You know, it wasn't that exciting to us. But I guess their house didn't look like that. But our house looked pretty neat. It was just what you'd make it. If you didn't clean it up, it was going to be bad. That was it.
How old were you when you got your first job?
My first job, I was about 11. And my mother had gotten a job at Hermitage Hotel in Nashville, Tennessee. And you could bring your daughter with you twice a week. This is how they did it. They said, you got to teach these girls to work. And the work was to work for them in a hotel as a maid. That's what they were teaching, that the women, the black women, bring their girls, daughters, nieces, whatever, to work with them and train them to be maids in a hotel. And my mother would take me with her a couple of times a week. And that's how I learned to clean. But that was my first job. 11 years old, they let you do it in the summer. You didn't do it in the winter, but in the summer months when school was out, all the mothers, any mother, they could bring their son if they wanted, but most of them brought their daughters to help them clean and clean up. It taught me that how people can come back from so much sadness and so much of people saying that they can do, and they did do. People thought that this is the end, I'll never come back from this, we'll never have anything, and they did come back. America came back. I would say don't ever depend on your government, really. It's all right if they do, but don't ever depend on your government bringing you out of your adversities. You have to do your part. And how can you expect them to do it all and you sit back and wait? Don't sit back and wait on anybody to do anything for you that you can do for yourself.
From this interview, I really learned about how tough times were during the Great Depression and how to get through tough times like that, you really have to stick with it and be resilient. And just keep working at it and trying the best that you can do. And I think another thing that I learned was just we take so many things for granted nowadays, like having clothing or actually having food to eat. We don't even think about it, and we probably overdo most of those things. So it really helps me by hearing somebody talk about it, talk about how you need to give money to those in need and actually try to help people instead of just helping yourself.
That's it for this edition of Regional Voices on The Big Read in partnership with the University of Southern Indiana. The Big Read is a program of the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm your host, Steve Berger. Thanks for listening. There are a number of book discussions and other public events in the month of February related to The Big Read. More information is available at usi.edu/bigread. You're listening to WNIN FM Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro. With your support, we're building a better tri-state together.